It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. Former FBI Director James Comey is in Seattle on the book tour for his new book, A Higher Loyalty. What do FBI agents think of what Comey is saying? A tax on big business to support affordable housing and service for the homeless? Sounds very Seattle. We're going to hear City Councilmember Mike O'Brien explain why he thinks it's a good idea, and Marilyn Strickland, head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, tell us why she doesn't agree. Also today, Spokane High School teacher Mandy Manning has been named the National Teacher of the Year. She teaches English and math to refugee and immigrant students. I'm looking forward to speaking to her later on in this hour. This is KUOW. After a legal hiccup in Olympia, voters, not lawmakers, will decide whether the state adopts new rules on police use of force. A group of citizens got the signatures necessary to get a measure on the ballot, Initiative 9940. State lawmakers just modified that and passed it. One problem, though. On Friday, Superior Court judge in Thurston County called foul, and Initiative I-940, as originally written, will have to be decided in November by voters. Austin Jenkins joins us. He's our Olympia correspondent. What's the difference between the citizens' initiative rules on use of force by police and the version that state lawmakers agreed to pass?
Well, it really has to do with the definition of what constitutes lawful and justifiable police use of deadly force. The language in the initiative is extremely troubling to the law enforcement community, and even the sponsors seem to agree that it's kind of convoluted and complicated, not as streamlined and simple to understand as you would want the test and the threshold to be. And so what this effort in the legislature in the final days of the 60-day session, when police and backers of this initiative and legislators came together, was to try to rewrite that threshold, make it simpler, and find agreement between really all parties.
Now, a Superior Court judge has ruled legislature, you can't do that. Lawyers for state legislators are already appealing this. How's it going to be resolved?
Well, this will go to the Supreme Court now. The Supreme Court will have the final say, but presuming that this Thurston County judge's ruling prevails and holds, it means that I-940 goes to the ballot without this companion or alternative solution. Really, what the legislature was trying to do is avoid a scenario where two different measures ended up on the ballot. They thought that that would sow confusion. The backers did. So they got maybe a little bit too clever by half and came up with this plan to pass Initiative 940 and amend it with a simple majority vote before it could even get to the ballot. And the judge is saying, nice try, but not constitutional. This was some lawyers getting together and thinking, we think this might work. We think that this might pass constitutional muster, and it gets us the clean single issue on the ballot. But again, you know, this is what happens when they come together at the last minute, try to forge a deal and a compromise in an extremely volatile issue, emotional issue, and legally complex issue, and then try to do an end run around the Constitution, and then it ends up in court. And now the question's going to be, is 940 going to pass in November? And if it does, what, if anything, does the legislature do to amend it next year when they come back into session? And keep in mind, that would take a two-thirds majority to do. It takes a supermajority to amend an initiative within the first 2 years.
But couldn't the appeal that the state legislature made to have its version of I-940 go on the ballot prevail?
That doesn't seem to be in the mix right now. I suppose we still have several months until the November ballot gets printed. That doesn't seem like the direction things are going. There was some talk of that in this legal challenge, but it's not what the advocates of this initiative or really lawmakers who are coming up with the alternative wanted to see happen, because once again, they were trying to avoid having two competing measures on the ballot. Generally, when that happens, both fail.
Right.
It is not a recipe for success. We saw that years ago with competing and dueling initiatives over medical malpractice insurance and limits, tort limits, and both of them went down in flames. So as a sponsor of an initiative, you really don't want to be up against another measure that, you know, has the same concept behind it.
So it sounds like the citizens' version of I-940, a bit stricter than what the legislature wanted, will be what we'll see in November.
Correct. At this point, that appears to be the case, unless the Supreme Court reverses course. The Secretary of State at this point is saying, I just want an answer from the Supreme Court quickly, because time is short. They want clarity about this, so they're going to ask for the Supreme Court to review this in an expeditious manner.
Austin, at the end of the day, do you think this initiative will pass before voters?
Yeah, I think that is a good question. I can't answer it. I will say that the general rule of thumb is that initiatives need to have about 60% support going into the election season because they tend to lose support as time goes by. But what remains to be seen is how actively the pro side pushes this initiative, whether they have the money to do that, and also whether the police unions and groups that are opposed to this particular version, this language, get money together, get organized, and run an opposition campaign. This is not an issue that naturally has a bunch of deep-pocketed donors sitting and waiting to jump in and spend a lot of money. And so I think that we really aren't clear yet how much we're going to hear from either side heading into the November election.
Has there been any polling suggesting whether or not this initiative, I-940, meets that 60% threshold as of right now?
I haven't seen recent polling. I think that it's fair to say that the initiative backers, anytime they're writing an initiative, are very mindful of that general rule of thumb. But this is also an issue that is really controversial, and it does divide people. This is certainly not an easy issue on the ballot, and it's not an automatic win, even when you look at the political makeup of Washington State.
Austin Jenkins, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Washington State's Teacher of the Year is now America's Teacher of the Year. We're going to talk with Spokane's Mandy Manning in just a moment on the record. I'm Ross Reynolds. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. The nation's new National Teacher of the Year didn't always want to be a teacher. Mandy Manning started out majoring in filmmaking in college. After getting a job as a teacher in a small rural town in Texas, she decided that teaching was her purpose. Well, now Mandy has been recognized for the work she's done teaching immigrant and refugee high school students in Spokane, Washington, and she joins us to talk about what it means to be Teacher of the Year. Mandy, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
In your new role, you're going to be traveling all over the U.S. and abroad doing speaking engagements, and you've said you want to share your students' stories because they're vitally important right now. Well, as I understand it, next week you're going to the White House to meet President Trump. What story will you share with him?
Well, I actually had my students write messages to the president and to the White House, the administration, and it was super easy to determine which stories I was going to tell because my students told me what stories to tell. So I have students from all over the world, and the things that keep them that are common amongst them all is, number one, of course, that they're learning English. But number two is that they view coming to the United States as an opportunity, a dream, a hope. It gives them hope that they can accomplish their dreams and achieve the things that they want to achieve in their future. So, for example, I have a student who's from Rwanda who happens to be on the varsity soccer team, and he has big dreams to go to university and to become a productive member of our community, and he just wanted me to make sure that I shared with the president that that is why he's here. He's here to become a productive member, and that coming here meant so much to him. It took him so long to get here, and he had to go through a lot of trauma to come here. And that's all he wants. He just wants a good life.
Now, the president's rhetoric on immigrants and refugees and certain countries in Africa has been quite harsh. Are you at all nervous about presenting that story to the president?
I'm not nervous about it. I think it's a very, very important message right now. And that particular student is not alone in the thoughts and feelings that he is experiencing here in the United States right now. So I welcome the opportunity, and I think that if I you know, share my experiences with these amazing students and share their experiences coming to the United States and the fact that they are going to be future citizens of our nation, I mean, how do you argue with that? These are beautiful people. They're members of our community. They are productive and have purpose, and they're eager to make connections with people who are already citizens here.
Mandy, at one time you aspired to be a filmmaker, as I understand it. What made you turn to teaching as your purpose?
Well, after I graduated from film school, I worked in a TV news station, and I just found that my personality wasn't really well suited to that line of work. And then I happened via a friend to get a position as a paraeducator in a special education classroom in Shelton, Washington. And I spent the year working with students in special education and also coaching Special Olympics basketball. And it was just a really lovely experience. I had never seen a program like that. And we did really amazing things where we built a boat and we, you know, worked with the kids to learn how life skills so that once they left high school, they could go on to be, you know, members of our communities. And so that was kind of the beginning. And I was interested, but I still wasn't sold. And I joined the Peace Corps right after that. And I taught in the Peace Corps, which, you know, I was teaching elementary students in Armenia. And that was also a lovely experience, but it was not anything like being a classroom teacher. So when I came back to the United States, you know, not having a degree in education or a teacher certification, I just figured that was the end of it. But when I moved to Texas, my aunt, who had been a teacher for years and years, she taught theater. She really encouraged me. She said that she felt that I had whatever, you know, some knack for teaching.
And there's a little bit of the theatrical in teaching, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to retain their attention.
Definitely. And so she encouraged me to apply, even though I wasn't certified. And I did. I landed a teaching position in a really small town. And I was teaching theater and communications and coaching speech and debate. And I just remember on that first day looking out at my classroom of students. And, you know, I was a bit of a misfit in North Texas, near the panhandle of Oklahoma. And these students who were taking, you know, theater were also a little bit of misfits. And I just remember their wide eyes, and they were so expectant and nervous and excited. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, I can have this huge impact on these kids, maybe, you know. Yeah. There's so much potential. I want to help them achieve the things that they want to achieve.
Mandy Manning is my guest, if you just tuned in. She's National Teacher of the Year. And she teaches English and culture to immigrant and refugees in Spokane, Washington, at the Newcomer Center of the Joel E. Ferris High School in Spokane. Have any of your students been deported, Mandy?
No, not yet. Mm-mm.
Well, how has the job as teaching these students changed in the last few years as the rhetoric against immigrants and refugees has increased?
So I've always been really intentional about making connections with my students and building relationships. But now with this current climate around immigrants and refugees, I am even more intentional about communicating to my students that they are wanted, they are loved, they are welcome here, and that they, too, just like their, you know, counterparts here in the U.S. who were born here, they have the potential to achieve their dreams, and that I am here to support them in doing that. And it's made me so much more intentional, and not just in my own words and actions with my students, but also in encouraging my fellow educators to do the same thing.
Now, I see that you've had a drop of the number of students in your classroom. You used to have 33. Now you're just down to 5. Why is that happening?
Well, There is an ebb and flow to the students coming in. The thing that I have seen change is that we are not having a steady stream of brand new immigrants and refugees coming in throughout the year. So usually I start the school year with a number around like 10 to 15 students because many new refugees come in over the summer. And then throughout the year, I get, you know, two students, you know, the next week, and then 5 students in November, and so on and so forth. And that continues throughout the whole year. Well, this year, because last year I had huge numbers. I had 33 in the fall semester, and I had 28 in the spring semester. And this year I started with a smaller number, around 10 or 12 students. And then it just kind of stopped. We didn't see, I think I got 3 additional students in that first semester, and then we didn't see any new students until around end of February end of February, and that is completely abnormal. Like, I've never had an experience like that in my 7 years teaching here, and there are some things that I understand about current policy And it's hard not to make a correlation. I cannot say for sure that it is connected, but I do know that we hit our refugee ceiling sometime around the end of at the end of the summer, and then there's been some other things that have happened in the interim. So it's really hard not to make a correlation. Although I just want to reiterate that I cannot say that definitively.
Mandy, what's the most challenging thing about teaching immigrants and refugee students?
To be honest, it's really not a challenge because my day is so full of beauty and fun experiences. And I guess the challenge, if I really, really, really had to think of one, was it's usually around that first week of school when the students are so nervous and scared. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge then is to ensure that they feel comfortable and excited and welcome in the classroom so that they are then willing to take some risks because they don't speak English when they first come in. And so it's very important that I set up that welcome environment so that they're willing to try new things.
How do you get over the language barrier when students show up and many of them can't speak English maybe at all or just a little bit? How do you teach them?
Well, so in the Newcomer Center, since every single student is in the same situation, they all speak about the same level of English, which is, very little. We're able to start with the basic foundations of language, which are, 1, 2, 3, A, B, C, hello, my name is. Mm-hmm. And so we start with those really, really, the basic concepts, and then we just stair step from there, and we just expand language and expand language and expand language. And so for me, it's just about ensuring that I'm, using very basic language, that I am very expressive when I speak, and that I am also using as many visuals and modeling as I can. And so it's really, I guess it would be a challenge to some. It's not a challenge to me because I just welcome the opportunity so much. I'm so excited to be with my students that I'm like, yes, we can do this.
So, Mandy, in June, you go from being the Washington State Teacher of the Year to the nation's Teacher of the Year. You're going to be traveling all over the U.S. and internationally. Will you get a chance to be in the classroom at all over the course of the year, or will your schedule keep you out of the classroom?
My schedule will mostly keep me out of the classroom, but of course, I think about all of my students, like Jimena and Belen from Guatemala and Gafishi from Rwanda and all of my students, oh my gosh, from all over, Hussein from Iraq, and I can't stay away. So as much as I can, every time I'm in Spokane, I'll definitely pop in and say hello.
One big issue on the minds of a lot of teachers all over the country is funding for education. And of course, in our state, the Supreme Court found that Washington State had been underfunding education. In Spokane, in your school, what does that look like?
Well, we're very honored here in Spokane to have a community that is extremely supportive. So we have been able to pass our levies and our bonds. And so we have not felt the funding crunch as heavily as some of the other communities who do not have as much community support, usually due to like geographical factors.
Have you had a chance to visit some of those other places less fortunate?
Yes, I have been able to see a lot. One of the major ones was Oaksdale in which is just really close here to Spokane, and just to see what it means when it's underfunded, because they had so many problems with their infrastructure of their buildings that they actually had a wall actually fall down, and to see
school fell down.
Yeah, they had this one hallway that was mostly windows, and it would just flood every year, and the kids just knew that they had to, walk around it. And then one day it just kind of finally crumbled, and they were able to passed this special type of a capital levy, and they were able to rebuild that wall, but you can still see there's still struggle. And then a white swan on the Yakima Reservation. Their school is really nice, but the community itself just has really faces some extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's just so important that we have these really strong public schools that can be the centers of our communities to help, you know, ensure that we can continue to have a productive and connected society. Yeah.
Well, Mandy, being National Teacher of the Year is a great honor and also a great opportunity for you to travel around the country, to share the stories of your students, to talk about what you see in the classroom. Do you in your mind have some idea of some concrete things you'd like to say to yourself at the end of the year that I did this as National Teacher of the Year? I accomplished this.
Well, of course, you know, we all have big dreams. But so number one,
dream big.
So number one, I would love to think that I have impacted people to you know, seek out experiences that are outside of their understanding so that we can be a more compassionate, connected community, for sure. And then also that I have elevated teacher leadership in such a way that our voices are being included in all decisions, whether mm-hmm. they're school building level or district level or state or national.
Mandy, how did your students react when they found out you had been given this honor?
Well, I've only seen some pictures because I haven't gotten to see them yet because it happened on Friday. But I think they were excited. I mean, for me, this award isn't really about me. It's about them. And, you know, like...
Yeah, but it's a little about you, too.
Well, my students definitely deserve this platform, and I am so excited to be that voice for them.
That's great. Mandy, thanks so much for talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Mandy Manning, English language development teacher at the Newcomer Center at the Joel E. Ferris High School in Spokane, Washington. She's finishing up her role as Washington State Teacher of the Year. And then she starts her role as National Teacher of the Year in June. Up ahead on The Record, FBI agents on their former leader, James Comey. It's The Record on KUOW. Sound stories, sound voices. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Well, former FBI Director James Comey is in Seattle. Last night he gave a sold-out speech at Seattle University. Today he's at Amazon. He's promoting his new book, A Higher Loyalty. The higher loyalty he's talking about is the rule of law. In Comey's account at a White House meeting, President Trump asked Comey to be loyal to him, a request that Comey responded to with a wordless stare. So how do former FBI agents feel about Comey's book and media tour? With us on the line, two FBI veterans with more than 40 years of experience between them. Kathy Laidler spent 23 years with the Bureau, retiring as designated acting special agent in charge of the FBI's field office in San Diego, California. She now heads up a security group in Seattle. Kathy, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Ross. Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
And also on the line, Carolyn Woodbury, who's been with the FBI for more than 20 years, most recently as a supervisory special agent in Seattle. Carolyn, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Hey, if you had the chance to sit down and have coffee with James Comey while he's here in Seattle, what would you want to talk to him about? Kathy?
Well, you know, that's very interesting. I had the pleasure of meeting Jim Comey about a year ago before he was fired as director of the FBI. He visited the Seattle office. I was there with a group of retired agents and current agents in the field office. He addressed the group for an hour and 20 minutes. I was quite impressed with him, and I did have a moment to chat with him just briefly. I found him to be very engaging, very much involved in the FBI and understanding the FBI culture. Seemed to be a really, really bright director. I never had an opportunity to work for him. But I think it would be interesting to you know, I think a lot of
water under the bridge since that last conversation. A lot of things have happened. He's gotten fired, and he's written this book, which is quite critical of the president. If you got to talk to him now, what would you like to talk to him about?
You know, I think I'd just like to ask him about his tenure in the FBI and talk to him a little bit more about the purpose of his book. His main focus seems to be more about leading from the front, and that's certainly something that FBI agents expect from their leader, from their director. I think I'd be very curious about a number of different things, about his interaction with Andrew McCabe, a little bit more about you know, the purpose of his book and you know, what message that he's trying to really get out there and convey to the American public that maybe FBI agents have had an opportunity to understand about him in the past because they've worked with him. But there are a lot of things, I think, that people don't know about him.
Hey, Carolyn, how about you? James Comey gives you a call this afternoon and says, hey, Carolyn, I'm in town. Let's hang out. You have coffee with him. What do you want to talk to him about?
I think I would kind of a little bit of what Kathy said. I would definitely, you know, sit down with him and talk to him. He's talked about his message, and he's having, you know, he's going out and talking to the different venues about what his book represents. And I think that's the one I'd be like, hey, is being an employee that worked for you and an employee that had a career in the FBI, what is the bottom message you would want, and how can we help as former employees get the right message across, not what maybe the media is spinning it as, but, you know, that you are trying to force, bring a conversation about ethical leadership and you know, developing, you know, who you are as a leader and the morals and stand behind what you believe and how that transcends into being an ethical leader and how we could support and get people motivated to read the book for those reasons.
Well, we don't have James Comey with us, but on the New York Times podcast, The Daily, Michael Barbaro asked Comey if he worries about the book tour and all the interviews he's doing. He wonders if that will contribute to the politicization of the FBI. And here's what Comey had to say.
I worry a little bit, which is why I'm so keen to make sure people understand what this book is about and what I hope to accomplish with this book. And that if people read it and have the kind of conversation I hope they'll have in the wake of it, it will actually be good for the reputation of the FBI and more broadly force a conversation about something that we're so busy reading tweets and fighting with each other about personalities that we're not having.
Kathy Laidler and Carolyn Woodbury, have either of you read the book, Carolyn?
I have started reading it. I have not finished it.
How about you, Kathy?
No, I haven't. Haven't had a chance yet.
Well, he's been on such a massive media tour. We've had plenty of chances to hear from him about the book. Does when you think about what he's had to say about it, do you think that it has harmed the reputation of the FBI, what he has had to say in that book and in public? Kathy?
Well, I think, you know, among the retired and former agents, we're definitely a house divided, but we will not fall. The FBI has demonstrated its resiliency since 1908. That's 110 years. I think, you know, one point I'd like to point out, and Carolyn and I have joked about this, not that it is a joke, but we find it, you know, very interesting that it's something that we were both taught at the Academy, and that is never, ever, ever embarrass the Bureau. I think the controversy among FBI agents goes to the fact that any public display that draws unwanted attention to the Bureau is a bit of an embarrassment to the Bureau, its employees, its mission, its stellar reputation. No one wants the FBI reputation to be tainted. And what I'm hearing among retired agents is that this book does jeopardize the FBI's reputation. It's really about the optics and the unwanted attention, the belief that it's inappropriate to talk publicly in a negative fashion about a sitting president, that it's bad protocol, unprecedented, ill-advised. These are things that I've heard. Even former supporters are somewhat upset. But still, from my position as a retired agent and never having worked for Jim Comey, but having met him, I believe that his heart was in the right place, and I would hope that his book really is a good display of examples of leadership from what he learned in the FBI as director for 3.5 years.
Carolyn Woodbury, supervisory special agent here in Seattle, you have worked under James Comey. Do you think that the book and his public statements is at all harmful to the FBI?
You know, I did work for him for the 3.5 years. I think overall, including myself, he is a very ethical leader and he's a man of integrity. And he was forced with, you know, just really bad choices. And he did what he could with an investigative group to come to the best choice that he could under the circumstances. And I think there's a sense between people in the Bureau and retired that, you know, that hopefully I don't think the book tarnishes the FBI. I think it brings unwanted attention where we like to be, I think, considered, you know, nonpartisan. You know, we are just a neutral force. And, you know, the book he has haters on both sides. And so it just draws some of that attention. But hopefully it draws that conversation among people to really look at what he's trying to do and to, you know, show to the American people how he made these decisions. And more importantly, you know, learn from mistakes, learn from, you know, good and bad decisions, learn to make the best choice with what you're given and lead morally and ethically. And hopefully people see that and not just, you know, what some of the bad stuff people are saying in the media.
Well, James Comey is coming for a lot of criticism. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette ran an editorial last week that read in part, "The person Mr. Comey has revealed himself to be over the last few days is completely at odds with what an FBI director should be. He is, by his own evidence, a score-settling bureaucratic conniver whose vanity has triumphed over his sense of duty and whose personal agendas obliterated the thing he most wanted to be, a good public servant." Carolyn, you've worked for James Comey. Do you think that's fair?
I don't think that's fair. I think people are judging him. They don't know all of the facts. You know, even in the FBI, we don't know all the evidence that was presented for them to hit for him and his investigative team to make the decisions and the hard decisions. We know leaders are made in tough times, and hopefully I worked for him. I support him, and I hope that this book does explain. I haven't completely read the book, but I hope it does bring some clarity and understanding.
Kathy, you've said you've got some reservations about the light that the FBI is being portrayed in because of Mr. Comey's statements and his book. But is he, by his own evidence, and I'm quoting the editorial here, a score-settling bureaucratic conniver whose vanity has triumphed over his sense of duty?
You know, I don't think I would characterize him that strongly, but I would say that from appearance, it does appear that he is trying to vindicate himself for just a horribly gross firing. And I didn't agree with the way that the president fired Jim Comey. I felt that could have been handled much more professionally in a quiet setting with the president face to face. And I think there's a lot of maybe it. I don't know. Maybe that's a question that I could go back and ask Jim Comey if I had a chance to ask him today. You know, does this book bring vindication to you for your firing? You know, is that why you wrote the book? And I don't know if that's exactly what he would say, or if he would say yes and affirm that to be true or not. But from some appearance, I think that's the belief of many former FBI agents that I have heard from, that this is more vindication for the firing.
Well, beyond views of the man, the timing of the book and the tour is worrying for Jonathan Turley. He's the constitutional law attorney at Georgetown. Here he is last week on Fox News.
You know, the fact that he rushed this book out is inexcusable. He was the head of this investigation and is now one of the cooperating witnesses. Nobody would suggest that this book is benefiting the investigation. To the contrary, he's undermining his role as a witness.
You both do investigations. Is this book harming the investigation that he's talking about?
Well, he said last night at SU, somebody brought that exact question up to him, and if I recall correctly, he stated that his statement is, you know, already on the record due to his testimony. The FBI reviewed the book, and I've heard him numerous times speak, and he is very consistent in all of those. So I don't think it's harming, because I don't think his statement's going to change. And that would be your biggest worry as an investigator.
And that's what he has said also. He says his testimony's locked down. He's said it many different times, and it's pretty much consistent. Is there any question of James Comey undermining his role as a witness?
I would not believe that would occur. Yeah. I would hope it would not occur.
I would hope that it would not occur, but I do question it, because I did hear him say that his testimony was locked down. His written testimony, that he had written memos, says that the book reflects it's very consistent with his testimony, but I have to question what is in the book that is not locked down and on the record. Mm-hmm. That would be my question. So I don't know, having not read the book, I'd have to go back and look at that, but I can tell you that with this political divide in this country, that book is under very, very close scrutiny politically, and I'm sure that if there is anything in there that isn't locked down, it'll be found.
And, of course, the stuff that people are really focusing on this book is what Comey has to say about Donald Trump. Here's his first impression. Here's what he told ABC.
He had impressively coiffed hair that looks to be all his. I confess I stared at it pretty closely, and my reaction was, must take a heck of a lot of time in the morning.
Appropriate for a former FBI director to say that about the president, Carolyn? What do you think?
You know, he's explained why he wrote that. You know, even on Colbert, I think it was Colbert, he said in the interview that he hopes it doesn't detract from the book. I kind of wish it wasn't in there so it wouldn't detract from what his message is and what he's trying to get out.
Kathy, what do you think about some of the personal things he's had to say about the president?
Well, I think it's an attempt to be humorous somewhat, right, but it's not appropriate. And I would certainly guard against and advise against any kind of comments like that made against a sitting president. I think it's inappropriate. Regardless of what side of the political aisle you're on, to me, it just, the optics are not good. It's not appropriate.
You know, the president has called Comey a liar. He said Comey should be in jail. He's called Comey the worst FBI director in history. The New York Times reported that Trump told two Russian officials that Comey was crazy, a real nut job. Should Comey be subjected to that abuse and not be able to respond, particularly since he's no longer in federal service?
Well, I don't think he should allow that kind of abuse, and I don't think that's appropriate for the president to say those things as well. And certainly, we all want to defend ourselves, but there's a way to do it, and I think it's maybe in a quiet way, in a different, maybe less is more in this case. He's gone out publicly, and he's attempting to be humorous and making comments about his handshake, the size of his hands, or the way he wears his hair. To me, it's just totally inappropriate for a director of the FBI to be making comments like that. And that in itself causes me to lose somewhat a bit of respect for him.
Robert Mueller leads the special counsel investigation of possible Russian interference in the 2016 elections and related matters. Both of you have worked under Robert Mueller. What's your impression of him? And also, President Trump has called the Mueller investigation a witch hunt, so there's a justified concern that he could end up firing Robert Mueller. What would that mean? What do you think, Kathy?
Well, from my experience, having worked under Robert Mueller as a director from 2001 until I retired in 2007, I met him a couple of times. I found him to be very serious. He's firm but fair. He held FBI employees accountable. He's extremely competent, a very smart man, and respected within the political community. As far as the investigation is concerned, I prefer not to really discuss anything about the investigation specifically because I'm not a part of it and I don't have all the facts, so I think it's best for me not to comment there. But Director Mueller, former Director Mueller, is probably a very good person for this job. There's no question about it. His legal acuity, if you will, he's a very smart man. And again, I think he's firm and fair.
We're going to have to end it there. That's Kathy Laidler, who spent 23 years with the Bureau. Also joining us, Carolyn Woodbury, an FBI agent for more than 20 years. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Ross. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for having us.
Up ahead, should Seattle adopt a head tax on employers to pay for affordable housing and services for homeless people? We'll hear two views of that. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds. Friday, three Seattle City Council members introduced a proposal for a head tax on Seattle businesses who have at least $20 million in taxable growth receipts. Remember that. We're going to go back to it. The city says it would apply to 500 businesses, and the money would be used to support construction of affordable housing and shelter for homeless people. The head tax comes in addition to an estimated $1 billion being spent now in the Puget Sound region on housing affordability and homelessness. It's called a head tax because it would impose a 26-cent fee per employee for every hour they worked. There would be an additional tax on large employers of 0.7% of payroll for work done in Seattle. The tax would begin next year and last until 2020. It's not the first time that Seattle has tried to impose a head tax. A similar measure passed in 2006 to fund education, and it was repealed 3 years later. Joining us with two perspectives on this, City Council Member Mike O'Brien, one of the three council members supporting the head tax, and also Marilyn Strickland, who heads the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce that she came to after being the mayor of Tacoma. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mike, I want to start out with one criticism of what the head tax actually does. It taxes gross receipts of a company, and I think it's important to understand that's different than profit. Businesses where the profit margin is small, like groceries, are saying this is unfair to them. What do you respond to that?
The ability to tax corporate profits instead of gross revenues. And so, you know, constantly willing to work with the Chamber of Commerce to go to Olympia and allow us to have an income tax instead of a gross sales tax. But the reality today is this is what we have. Now, as you noted, the proposal would be an hours tax for the first 2 years, and then it would shift to a payroll tax. And the distinction there is a payroll tax would be scaled based on the cost of your labor. So a grocery store that may have a lot lower paid workforce would actually pay less under that, and a tech company who may pay their workers a lot more may pay more. So that's a goal in the longer term.
Marilyn Strickland with the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, would you support or not oppose an amended head tax? Is there something that could be done to make it compatible with what you think should be done?
Well, the 2,200 businesses that we represent, which is about 700,000 employees, really does not think that it's necessary to engage in any kind of taxing, whether it's a head tax or a payroll tax. And here's why. This is really a conversation about the abundance of the city of Seattle's coffers because of this boom that they're experiencing. You see construction everywhere. They have record revenues from sales tax, property tax, B&O tax, utility tax. And if dedicating more funds to combat homelessness, which is something we support, by the way, is something that's a priority for the city council, then they should be looking to their generous coffers to make that decision instead of imposing yet another tax on business.
Mike O'Brien, one thing to always ask ourselves when we're thinking about imposing new taxes is, what do we get from it? If you are to pass this and it goes into effect, you'll raise quite a bit of money to go towards affordability and homelessness. How would we measure the success of this expenditure? What will we get for that?
Sure. So the biggest chunk of the revenue would be directed towards building more affordable housing units. We already have structures in place where we fund affordable housing units. Through taxpayers, we've built thousands of units of affordable housing in the city of Seattle. Last year, we opened up an additional 250 units. This year is going to be another 350 units, but we need more. This proposal would dedicate 75% of the revenue towards additional affordable housing units, and we project we could build almost 2,000 additional units in the next 5 years from this revenue stream alone.
But what will the result of that be? Will there be more affordable housing in Seattle or less unaffordable housing? What will happen if we spend that money?
Well, what it means is that every year we will have more new affordable housing units opening up, and those are units that either people that are on the edge of becoming homeless could move into, or people that are currently experiencing homelessness and are moving through the shelter system, we can move them out of those shelters or off the streets into affordable housing so that they can get their life stabilized and be housed successfully.
Marilyn Strickland, you said you're not opposed to spending more money on these things. Well, if it doesn't come from a tax that would affect employers, where should it come from?
It should come from the generous city coffers that exist right now. And I come back to my original point. Well, one of the conversations that's happening in this is that you hear people say, well, business needs to do its fair share. And I like to remind folks that business now contributes over half into the city's general fund at $700 million a year.
Is that enough?
In addition to that, a lot of our...
Would you say that's not
accurate either. I'm sorry. The sales tax, I believe you're including that, Marilyn. And sales tax is actually a tax on consumers and the businesses collected on their behalf. But to call that a business tax is unfair.
Marilyn?
Well, there's a B&O tax that Seattle does have, and that's something
that
a lot of cities around the country don't have. And so whether you want to try to parse words about sales tax, the fact is that $700 million does come from the business community. But on top of that, we're not talking about necessarily, you know, does the city have the capacity? If it's a priority, the city has the opportunity to look inside its coffers right now and redirect existing funds. And one argument you will hear is, well, we can't cut back on fire and police. Fire and police do not make up 100% of city's coffers, and so there's an opportunity to prioritize it, redirect funds, and also to take a regional approach to this, because one thing that we know is true is that homelessness is a regional problem, and it's happening across, you know, communities all over America. And so instead of having the city of Seattle take on a disproportionate responsibility for this, we should look regionally and look at the resources that exist at a regional level.
We're talking about a proposed head tax in Seattle. Basically, that would tax businesses at first for a certain amount of money, 26 cents per employee per hour, and then it would change into a payroll tax a little bit down the line. We're talking to Mike O'Brien, the city council member who's supporting this, and also Marilyn Strickland with the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce who opposes it. Mike, another criticism of this head tax I've heard is that we're already spending quite a bit of money on this, and that even though we've increased spending by 39%, the number of unsheltered homeless has increased by 37% along the same time period. How do we know the money will be effective at dealing with this, what I think we all could agree is a grave problem?
Yeah, it's a crisis. And, you know, as Marilyn said, it's not just a city problem. It's a regional problem. It's actually a national problem. We have a national crisis. Certainly, look up and down the West Coast. Our peer cities are struggling under the same immense pressure. And we do need a national solution to this. We need a national solution to the opiate epidemic. We need national federal funding for mental health care. And we need national, state, and regional solutions to this. And I am 100% behind making those happen. What I can't do is sit around and wait for years for those to materialize. Well, people are suffering on the streets, and our businesses and residents are being impacted by the presence of so many more homeless in our community. We have to take action.
I guess I want to know, Mike, is if the more money we have spent over the last 4 years hasn't worked, how do we know that more money than that will work?
You know, Ross, it's a good question, and it's a fair question. Last year, the city's investments alone helped 3,400 people exit homelessness and get into permanent housing. So we have a lot of data to demonstrate how much the money is doing, and we can point to all that. The problem is when you have thousands more people entering homelessness every year because of an underfunded mental health system, because rapidly rising rents, we are being overwhelmed. And we've taken our existing system, our existing homeless system, which had worked generally till about a decade ago, and you add these new crises on top of it, and we simply have not been able to keep up. Last summer, we opened up a couple hundred new shelter beds, and what that allowed us to do was immediately get people out of the most dangerous living situations on the street into the Navigation Center, into a new tent city, into a new tiny home village. But after about 2 months, those beds were all full, and those folks didn't have affordable housing to move on to, and so the system gets stuck once again. That's why we think adding new emergency shelter beds so that we can get more people off the street and significantly investing in more affordable housing units to get the throughput through the system working better at the scale of the problem we're facing today.
Mike O'Brien, is this proposal locked down? Is it open for amendments? Could it change?
No, we have about a month of legislative process, so we will be engaging with the public. There's a public hearing happening tonight at 5:30 at Seattle City Hall, and there'll be a number of committee meetings happening over the course of the next month. I'm hosting a town hall on May 2nd in Ballard in the evening, and so we will be looking for feedback, just like this conversation I'm having with Marilyn, and figuring out how to make this work best. And at the end of the day, it's going to take a majority of the council to vote for it.
Marilyn Strickland, can you see amendments to this that would make it amenable to you and the other people with the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce?
So I don't see any amendments that are going to make us say we support this.
Okay.
But as we look at the entire, you know, if we look at this issue in its totality, you know, Mike is right. There is a woefully underfunded mental health system, not just at the national level, at the state level. Washington State ranks low when it comes to our funding for mental health services. But I also, too, want to point out that, you know, our position as employers isn't that we don't want to help people who are homeless. We think we have a very specific role to play. And if you look at some of the data points that come back about how people find themselves homeless, you know, you have a large number of people who suffered from job loss. And so how do we as employers work with our social service agencies to say we can give people second chances to get them back on their feet? We can engage in job training and outreach to try and employ folks. And so I think the business community has a role to play. But if you look at the cumulative effect of taxes and fees and regulations on the business community, there's a reason that we had, you know, 300 business owners sign a letter to the city council saying, please don't do this. There's a reason that an additional... Go ahead.
Just a final question for you, Mike. Have you counted city council heads to determine if this head tax has enough votes to pass the council?
Well, we have a process going forward, Ross. There are actually four of us that are co-sponsors of this legislation, so that's a good start. Another colleague who was not a sponsor, Councilmember Sawant, put out a press release last week saying she was very supportive of it. So, you know, we start where there's at least five people indicating support, which is a good spot to be in. But, you know, there's a process that goes through. We're going to hear from a lot of people in the next month, and people will be adapting as we get through that.
Mike O'Brien, city council member, supporting the head tax, which we've just explained, and also Marilyn Strickland with the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce opposing it. Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ross.
All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon. That's all for today. The Record produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano, and our social media producer is Bree Ripley. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to meet the Beyonce of earthquakes. Yes, seismologist Lucy Jones. Her new book is called The Big Ones. Maybe she'll bring a marching band. I'm Ross Reynolds. Thanks for listening.